The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We wish to thank them for their support. We're reading today from the November 2018 edition of Smithsonian, The Past is Prologue, by Richard Conniff, Political Animal. After years of fierce debate, the West's greatest symbol will again roam the plains. This winter, if all goes as planned, a caravan of livestock trucks will carry dozens of American bison out of Yellowstone National Park on a 500-mile journey into the past. Unlike their ranched cousins, which are mainly the result of 20th-century attempts to cross bison with cattle, the Yellowstone animals are wild and genetically pure, descendants of the original herds that once astonished visitors to the Great Plains and made the bison the symbol of American abundance. Until, that is, rampant hunting made it a symbol of mindless ecological destruction. When the mass slaughter of 30 million or so bison finally ended at the turn of the 20th century, just 23 wild bison remained in Yellowstone, holed up in Pelican Valley. Together with a small number of animals saved by ranchers, that meager herd became the basis for the recovery of the entire species, bison, which has been nurtured back to strength in the park. Yellowstone has done its job so well, in fact, that the herd now consistently exceeds 4,000 bison, a number large enough to provoke fears of overgrazing in the park and of bison roaming beyond its boundaries. Park rangers have thus had the disheartening annual job of rounding up excess bison for slaughter, or watching some step across the park's northern border into a hunt that critics deride as a firing squad. Relocating the animals would be the humane alternative, except for a scary problem. Ranchers and others have long maintained that bison spread brucellosis, a bacterial infection that is devastating to cattle. A 2017 study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, however, determined that every case of brucellosis in cattle in the region over the past 20 years came from infected elk, not bison. That finding made it harder to argue that wild bison shouldn't be allowed out of the park. The Park Service will ship the bison to the Sioux and Assiniboine tribal nations at Fort Peck Reservation in northeastern Montana. A small herd of Yellowstone bison has been thriving there since a modest 2012 feasibility experiment. The plan is to build up that herd and create a bison pipeline, says Robbie Magnan, the reservation's fish and game director. As more animals arrive from Yellowstone, the Fort Peck tribes will gradually export bison, commonly called buffalo on the reservation, to start protected herds on other reservations and conservation lands. On a practical level, the relocation program is simply a way to keep the Yellowstone population in check. But it is also much more than that. The move begins to restore wild bison to the Great Plains and the Plains Indians, who depended on them for food, clothing, and shelter. It has a real spiritual meaning for us, says Magnan. The buffalo were taking care of Native Americans from the beginning of time, and now we need to help them. The fates of indigenous people and bison have long been intertwined in the eyes of the government, too. Federal agents, 150 years ago, proposed exercising control over the Plains Indians by eradicating the bison in what General William Tecumseh Sherman called one grand sweep of them all. Renewed interest in the future of wild bison, including its 2016 designation as the U.S. national mammal, comes as the conventional account of their near extinction is facing fresh scrutiny. The story that eyewitnesses and historians have told since the 1870s is that the destruction of the bison, almost overnight, was the work of ruthless white hunters, arriving by railroad and armed with the latest weaponry. But that account may be too simple. Citing fur trade records, archaeological data, and contemporary accounts, environmental historians such as Andrew Eisenberg at the University of Kansas and Dan Flores at the University of Montana argue that white hunters administered the crushing final blow, but only after a century of environmental challenges and Native American overhunting. The spread of horses on the Great Plains in 1680 onward gave tribes a new, highly efficient means of pursuing their prey. More Native Americans were also eking out a living from the fiercely variable Great Plains environment. As settlers displaced them from traditional territories, and commercial demand meant a huge market for bison hides. Other researchers worry that this contrarian version of history will invite misunderstanding. People hear only Indians were involved too, says Philip Deloria, a Harvard professor of Native American history, and that has the effect of letting the others off the hook, and of letting the explicit military strategy of destroying Native American resources off the hook. Deloria argues that the Native Americans' culture, based on the idea of subsistence, prevented them from annihilating the bison in the same way white market hunters did. It's tempting to see a happy ending to this story in the restoration of the American bison. People working together can pull a species back from the brink. Today, bison are considered near threatened by the International Union of Conservation of Nature. But another battle over this shaggy, snorting symbol lies ahead as ranchers face larger fears about a resurgent bison herd. Competition for grass, water, and other limited resources vital to their own uncertain future. There's a sidebar chart titled Wild America. A new study shows the surprising places where animals would be living if we weren't here. If we hadn't been so busy hunting animals and destroying their habitats, where would they be living today? Biologists in Sweden and Denmark take aim at that question. Their innovative new databases estimates the present natural ranges of all 5,831 mammals known to exist in the last 130 years. Most current ranges are smaller, but not all. Here are some notable changes in the lower 48. Bison. In the early 1800s, bison ranged from Mexico to Canada. By 1902, free-range wild bison remained only in Yellowstone. Wild horse. Different from today's feral horses, wild horses disappeared in the Americas, likely due to hunting, about 11,000 years ago. Black-footed ferret. It was driven almost to extinction, largely by early 20th century efforts to eradicate prairie dogs, its main food. Gray and red wolves, nearly eliminated by ranchers and hunters in the lower 48 in the mid-1900s, still in danger, in part because of dislike. Brown bear. Centuries of hunting reduced the bear's range. Recent conservation efforts fostered some expansion near Yellowstone. Cougar. Human population growth has pushed the big cats west. The eastern subspecies was declared extinct this year. Coyote. A declining wolf population contributed to the coyote's wider range. The species is now moving towards South America. And lastly, nine-banded armadillo. As humans killed black bears and other predators, the armadillo moved north, crossing the Rio Grande in the 1880s. Next up, World War II. Churchill disses America. Our exclusive first look at the diaries of King George VI reveals Winston Churchill's secret hostility to the United States by Andrew Roberts. The gift of a common tongue is priceless inheritance, and it may well someday become the foundation of a common citizenship, Winston Churchill prophesied in his famous speech at Harvard University on Monday, September 6, 1943. I like to think of British and Americans moving about freely over each other's wide estates, with hardly a sense of being foreigners to one another. His mother having been born in Brooklyn of American parentage, Churchill believed that he personified what he later called the special relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States. It was long a theme of his. He had been making speeches on the subject of Anglo-American unity of action since 1900, and in 1932 had signed a contract for his book, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples, which emphasized the same thing. If we are together, nothing is impossible, he continued that day in 1943. If we are divided, all will fail. I therefore preach continually the doctrine of the fraternal association of our two peoples, for the sake of service to mankind. He proclaimed that doctrine for the rest of his life. Indeed, on the day he resigned the premiership in April 1955, he told his cabinet, "Never be separated from the Americans." Throughout a political career that spanned two-thirds of a century, Churchill never once publicly criticized the United States or the American people. In all of his 16 visits to the United States between 1895 and 1961, with 8 as Prime Minister and almost half of them after 1945, he studiously confirmed himself to public expressions of support and approbation. Yet, as I discovered while writing my new biography, Winston Churchill, Walking with Destiny, he often took a very different stance in private. From a variety of new sources, including the wartime diaries of King George VI in the Royal Archives at Windsor Castle, opened to me by the gracious permission of Her Majesty the Queen, it is clear that Churchill regularly expressed searing criticism of the United States, and especially the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt during World War II. The newly published diaries of Ivan Meisky, the Soviet ambassador in London from 1932 to 1943, verbatim war cabinet records that I discovered at the Churchill Archives, and the papers of Churchill's family, to which I have been given privileged access, all provide confirmation. As the first Churchill biographer to be allowed to research the King's expurgated wartime diaries, I was surprised at the depth of ire that Churchill sometimes directed toward Britain's greatest ally, indeed, in many ways, Britain's savior. Much can be put down to the frustration he naturally felt toward American military non-intervention in Europe after Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States on December 11, 1941. But there was a good deal of anti-American venting thereafter, too. Churchill's relationship with his mother country was much more complex than the Harvard speech and the rest of his public stance implied. Although he had enjoyed his first trip to the United States in 1895 at age 20, Churchill's initial attitude toward Anglo-American unity was sarcastic, bordering on the facetious. When his mother, the socialite Jeanie Jerome, proposed publishing a magazine dedicated to promoting that idea in March 1899, he wrote from Calcutta, where he was serving as a junior cavalry officer, that the motto she wanted to adopt, "Blood is thicker than water," had long ago been relegated to the pothouse music hall. He sneered at her concept of printing the Union Jack across with the stars and stripes on the front cover as cheap, and told her that the popular idea of the Anglo-American alliance, the wild impossibility, will find no room among the literary ventures of the day. From the beginning, his attitude was one of clear-eyed, unsentimental realpolitik. "One of the principles of my politics," he told his mother in 1898, "will always be to promote the good understanding between the English-speaking communities. As long as the interests of two nations coincide, as far as they coincide, they are and will be allies. But when they diverge, they will cease to be allies." Churchill fully appreciated the United States' entry into World War I in April 1917. "There is no need to exaggerate the material assistance," he wrote in his book The World Crisis, "but the moral consequence of the United States joining the Allies was indeed the deciding cause in the conflict. Without America, the war would have ended in a peace by negotiation, or, in other words, a German victory. In the 1920s, Churchill was highly critical of the United States' determination to build a fleet equal in power and tonnage to the Royal Navy's. There can really be no parity between a power whose navy is its life and a power whose navy is only for prestige, he wrote in a secret cabinet memorandum in June 1927 while he was Chancellor of the Exchequer. It always seems to be assumed that it is our duty to humor the United States and minister to their vanity. They do nothing for us in return but exact the last pound of flesh. The next month he went much further, writing that although it was quite right in the interests of peace to say that war with the United States was unthinkable, in fact, everyone knows this is not true, for however foolish and disastrous such a war would be, we do not wish to put ourselves in the power of the United States. Evidently, on the basis of American naval superiority, speciously disguised as parody, immense dangers overhang the future of the world. The next year, speaking after dinner to the conservative politician James Scrimgeour Wedderburn at Churchill's country house, Chartwell Manor in Kent, he said that the U.S. was arrogant, fundamentally hostile to us, and that they wished to dominate world politics. Herbert Hoover's election to the presidency in November 1928 made matters worse because of his tough stance on British repayment of war debts and the effect that had on the economy, which Churchill was still stewarding as Chancellor of the Exchequer. Poor old England, he wrote to his wife, Clementine. She is being slowly but surely forced into the shade. Clementine wrote back to say that he should become Foreign Secretary, but I am afraid your known hostility to America might stand in the way. You would have to try and understand and master America, and to make her like you. But his hostility to America was not known beyond the cognoscenti inside the government, as he assiduously kept it out of his many speeches. The outbreak of World War II naturally intensified Churchill's determination to allow no word of public criticism to drop from his lips, especially of Roosevelt. Considering the soothing words he always uses to America, noted his private secretary, Jock Colville, 9 days after Churchill became prime minister in May 1940, and in particular to the president, I was somewhat taken aback when he said to me, "Here's a telegram from those bloody Yankees. Send it off tonight." During the Battle of Britain, Churchill said the Americans' morale was very good in applauding the valiant deeds done by others. A week before Roosevelt was reelected in 1940, Colville recorded in his diary that Churchill said he quite understood the exasperation which so many English people feel with the American attitude of criticism combined with ineffective assistance, but we must be patient and we must conceal our irritation. Any hope Churchill had that Roosevelt's electoral victory might bring the United States into the war against the Nazis had evaporated by New Year's Day, 1941, when British faced bankruptcy because it had to pay cash for all the munitions and food it was buying from the United States. Churchill told Colville, "The Americans' love of doing good business may lead them to denude us of all our realizable resources before they show any inclination to be the Good Samaritan." As well as expressing these criticisms to his private secretary and to some cabinet colleagues, Churchill also told the monarch what he really thought of Roosevelt and the Americans. His relations with King George VI were not initially good when he became prime minister, largely because Churchill had supported the king's elder brother, Edward VIII, later the Duke of Windsor, during the abdication crisis 4 years earlier. But during the months of the fall of France, the Battle of Britain, and the London Blitz, they swiftly improved, and by 1941, Churchill was confiding in the king at their private lunches at Buckingham Palace every Tuesday. They served themselves from a sideboard so that no servants need be present, and after each meeting, the king wrote in his diary what Churchill had told him. His diary is held in the Royal Archives. at the Round Tower at Windsor Castle. The tower's origins may be traced to the 11th century, soon after the Norman conquest, but King George IV added the top floor in the early 19th century. Because there are no elevators, every trip to the summit involves a mini workout, which is rewarded by magnificent views of Berkshire and the surrounding counties. But I had little time to gaze out the windows as I made the most of my extraordinary opportunity to examine King George VI's diary, which I was allowed to do one blue leather-bound volume at a time, and under constant oversight, even on trips to the lavatory, though the staff, even while providing such eagle-eyed supervision, was unfailingly able and friendly. The Americans are all talk and do nothing while Japan lands fresh forces in Sumatra, Sarawak, and others, the Prime Minister complained to the King soon after Pearl Harbor was attacked in December 1941. A month later, he insensitively added of the dangers of a Japanese invasion of Australia. The U.S. fleet would have prevented this from happening had her fleet been on the high seas instead of at the bottom of Pearl Harbor. That April, as the Japanese Navy threatened Allied shipping in the Bay of Bengal and the Indian Ocean, he said, "We are in a hole, and the USA fleet is in San Francisco, doing nothing to help." On New Year's Day, 1943, Churchill said of future Allied strategy, "We have to collaborate with the Americans over these matters, as we cannot do them without their help. They are so slow in training their army and getting it over here." Churchill was clearly jealous of the leading position the Americans had assumed through their vastly superior production of war material by the spring of 1943. Winston is keen on an imperial conference, the King noted that April, so as to discuss the question of putting up a united British Commonwealth and empire to show the world and USA that we are one unity. The Americans are always saying they are going to lead the post-war world. A week later, the Prime Minister expressed his completely unfounded suspicions that the USA really wants to fight Japan and not Germany or Italy. By October, he was insisting, "The USA cannot have supreme commanders both here and in the Mediterranean, and we must not allow it. The Med is our affair, and we have won the campaigns there." That was not true either, as the King must have known. The U.S. Army fully shared the trials of the Italian campaign from the invasion of Sicily in 1943 onward, and indeed, it was the American general Mark Clark who was the first to enter Rome on June 5, 1944. In March 1944, Churchill likened the strategic situation in Europe to a bear drunken with victory in the east and an elephant lurching about in the west, while we in the UK were like a donkey in between them, which was the only one who knew the way home. By July 4, nearly a month after D-Day, he was reporting to the King that, over his pleas to Roosevelt to fight in the Balkans rather than the south of France, he was definitely annoyed at FDR's reply and put out that all our well-thought-out plans had been ignored by him and the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. A month later, he worried that with Generals George S. Patton and Omar Bradley advancing faster in Germany than General Bernard Montgomery, the two Americans may want to separate their army from ours, which would be very stupid. Yet there was not a whisper of this antipathy in Churchill's telegrams to the Americans, let alone in his public references in the Commons and his broadcast to the Allies. He ripped up many bad-tempered telegrams to Roosevelt before sending much more temperate ones. In particular, he kept private his resentment that the Americans did not support taking a tougher stance against the Soviet Union over Polish integrity and independence after the Yalta Conference of February 1945. Winston was not satisfied with FDR's reply to his telegram regarding Poland, the King noted on March 13. It was much too weak, and the Russians want to be told matters strongly. The next month, Churchill told Clementine, "Undoubtedly I feel much pain when I see our armies so much smaller than theirs. It has always been my wish to keep equal, But how can you do that against so mighty a nation with a population nearly three times our own? It was impossible. But while Churchill is often accused of appeasing the United States, in fact, he promoted Anglo-American unity because it served Britain's best interests. His public reticence to criticize the United States reflected two aspects of his character that were often to the fore throughout his political career. The first was his capacity ruthlessly to sacrifice the trivial and the short term for the greater prize. The second was his powerful sense of personal and national destiny. He foresaw a time when Britain would need the United States desperately. This article has a sidebar with the title Diplomacy with Allies Like These. The Big Three worked together to end World War II, but behind their public partnership, the 1943 Tehran Conference, below were private put-downs. Printed over a photograph of Joseph Stalin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill sitting together are bubbles with what they are presumably thinking. Stalin on Roosevelt. And Roosevelt? Roosevelt is not like that. He dips in his hand only for bigger coins. And also Stalin thinking on Churchill. Churchill is the kind who, if you don't watch him, will slip a kopeck out of your pocket. Yes, a kopeck out of your pocket. By God, a kopeck out of your pocket. And it shows Roosevelt thinking on Churchill. He is a mid-Victorian of restoring the British Empire. Dear old Winston will never learn on that point. And Churchill is thinking on Stalin. Trying to maintain good relations with a communist is like wooing a crocodile. You do not know whether to tickle it under the chin or beat it over the head. When it opens its mouth, you cannot tell whether it is trying to smile or preparing to eat you up. And we'll wrap up with a letter from Lois Sobel of Chapel Hill to Smithsonian. Susan Orlean's Zooming In on Petra did more than justice to this amazing place, which I've also visited. It enhanced my understanding. It is amazing to see what is behind the facades of the structures, and even more amazing is that the site has survived centuries of neglect. And a clarification. In Contributor's September issue, the entry on Lisa Elmea implied that wet plate, collodion, and tintype are two separate photographic methods. In fact, they are versions of the same process, applied to either glass or tin. And that wraps up today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.